Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, I'm Bede Hill, and this is The D Word, the show where we talk dementia. Welcome along to The D Word here on UK Health Radio, and show number 222 since we started back in June 2019. Since then, I've enjoyed talking to some great guests, and there's many more on the way, including this week when I'm going to be chatting to Quinn Kennedy, Director of Aging Research at NeuroFit. Quinn will be joining me right after this from Larry Gamble and Teresa Williams.
You got my number, you rang my phone, said come on over, don't sit home, I'm alone. Well, it's been so long since I met anyone like you. So if you see me roll up to your door doing cartwheels, you got a brand new couch, and we can watch TV. I'll put an arm around you, we'll see whatever you wanna see. Yeah, I don't mind, 'cause I'd do anything for you. So if you see me dance up to your door, click in my heels.
The Way You Make Me Feel by Larry Gamble and Teresa Williams, kicking off this week's edition of The D Word, where my guest is Quinn Kennedy. I first saw Quinn at a virtual conference we both appeared at earlier in the year and was fascinated by her presentation on cognitive ageing. So I was delighted when she agreed to join me here on The D Word. Well, Quinn, welcome to the D Word. It's great to have you with me. Got plenty to talk about. I've looked at your LinkedIn. I think that's probably how we first communicated. And you're a director of aging research working at the intersection of cognitive aging tech and finance. Just explain to us a little bit about that title.
So the director of aging research is for a startup company called NeuroFit, where we are developing a product that I feel can help people be able to monitor their own brain health from the privacy and comfort of their own home. So I'm pretty excited about that. And then I give talks to the public, and some of those talks look at the relationship between cognitive aging, risk for dementia, and then the associated risk for financial exploitation as we get older. So that's kind of the link between those three things.
And is that an area you've always been interested in, or, you know, how did you arrive at where you are?
Gosh, it's been kind of a long, winding path. You know? So I originally got interested in this field when I moved to California for the heck of it, and I needed a job, and I ended up applying at the Stanford VA Alzheimer's Center, and I got the position as a research assistant, and I loved it. I loved it. I was the one who would communicate with the patients and their caregivers and administer some of the cognitive tests. And so that inspired me to apply to graduate school to learn more about adult aging. And then it kind of went from there, I would say.
Yeah, it's kind of, I thought many years ago, well, the heck, I'll have a go at radio. And that's kind of where I've ended up. I mean, the whole thing about cognitive aging, I mean, unfortunately, we've been doing the show 5 years now. And I still don't think I'm anywhere near busting that myth that thinks that dementia is a normal part of aging. You know, how do we go about, you know, finally just getting rid of that one so we can concentrate on more important things?
Well, I would say there's two things. One is to help people realize that they actually have more control over their cognitive aging process than many people realize. You know, there's been some studies that show that living a healthy lifestyle can reduce your risk for dementia by up to 60%, which is huge, right? This is just common sense things that your mom told you when you were growing up. And then the other thing is I would recommend people read Becca Levy's Breaking the Age Code, because she talks about how, you know, believing these false myths about the aging process can become self-fulfilling prophecy, because then you don't do the health benefiting things that you should be doing. And then you do end up having dementia or whatever other age-related health issues. So those are the two things that I would say is realizing we have more control than over that process than many people think, and looking at her book.
It does say, you know, a really good recommendation. I mean, you know, talking about control, we seem to have got it a little bit with things like a heart health. Here in the UK, we have adverts, you know, good for your heart, etc. And things seem to have been taken on like that. But I'm still yet to see something that treats brain health in the same way. And it's a, you know, it's a very important organ of the body, holds everything together, but we still seem to ignore it.
Yeah, I would say here in the U.S., the Alzheimer's Association's been doing a big push towards educating the public about that. They have a whole, they're involved in what they're calling a healthy brain initiative towards getting the word out. But I agree that a lot of people still don't know that there's a lot that they can do to promote their own brain health.
And that, you know, there seems to be this thing about, well, I'm getting older, so those things will happen. But I looked at one of your blogs, and one of the facts there, scientists have discovered about 30% of older adults have younger brains than their chronological age. But that came as a surprise to me. So I guess it'll come as a surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think at some point, from a scientist's perspective, we're going to move away from this chronological age, right? Like, and more into what I call the functional age, right? Like, which is how old is your brain at a functional level compared to your chronological age? And I think it's really important for people to realize, as you said, that there is a, 30% of people have brains that are younger than their chronological age. And again, it's probably due to some of the lifestyle that they're following in part.
And I guess it is looking across the life course approach, isn't it? And not just saying, you know, hey, I've got 50 now, whoops, I better watch what I'm doing. But really, it's right from the beginning.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, some people argue that we should be teaching this stuff in high school, right? And just putting it on kids' radars. I mean, certainly, I think when we hit our 40s and 50s, it is definitely a time to pause and reflect on our lifestyle and make changes that may be necessary, because more and more research is showing that midlife period is a really crucial point. It's kind of the inflection point in the road towards staying on a healthy path versus going down a more undesirable path. So your 40s and 50s are really, really important.
It's something certainly for people to watch out. I've gone a bit beyond that, but I'm still watching out. So hopefully everything will be okay. But when you're doing your workshops and going around and meeting people, what kind of reaction do you get when you start saying the kind of things that, you know, you've just told us in the last few minutes? Is it a big surprise to people?
What I've been told is that people feel hope after learning this, that there is something that they can do. I would say that's the biggest reaction that I've gotten. I think, you know, depending on the audience, some of these people already know some of this information, so they're not that surprised. But I think providing some information about what scientific studies have found out can be motivating to people too. So I would say hope and motivated are kind of the two big reactions that I get.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
That's the Monfales and New Year's Eve here on UK Health Radio. Coming up shortly, we'll be issuing the nominees for this year's UK Health Radio Awards. And I'm pleased to say there will be a dementia support category once again. So watch out for details on the website at www.ukhealthradio.com. Back to my chat now about cognitive ageing with my guest, Quinn Gennady. And there are these kind of 12 modifiable risk factors. And a lot of the stuff you said is pretty, obvious stuff that you taught, smoking, blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. But I still get the feeling that they are modifiable risk factors for a number of conditions, dementia being one of them. But dementia seems to sit in this bubble in the corner. And it doesn't seem to join the rest of the public health message there. I don't know if I'm misinterpreting it, but that's kind of what I think.
I think that's a great point, Pete. I think, there's a new field developing called geroscience. I think it's called geroscience, where they're making exactly that point, that a lot of these chronic conditions, the main risk factor is age. And they're all kind of related at that biological level, at that mitochondrial level and all that kind of stuff. And dementia is just part of that. So I think that is a new direction that scientists are in terms of thinking about this. But I do agree that that dementia seems to be siloed compared to cardiovascular health and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, it's frustrating that it's not related. And also, I guess, part of it is the message, I guess, because, you can have the message of do this and prevent that, or turn it around its head and say that actually you'll get better if you do this. And there seems to be a bit of a, sometimes there's a bit of a doom and gloom message that people seem to say, oh, yeah, well, okay. Whereas, you put more positive spin on it, like the fact we brought out about, older adults having younger brains. And surely, you're going to get a better message there and more people willing to take it on board.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know how to get that message out, more fully. I'm just trying to do my little bit here.
Yeah, and I think that's, that's really important. I've looked on the website, lots of really useful stuff. And I guess one of the things, there's a really nice little concise leaflet on there about the differences between normal aging and something more serious, which again, you talk about hope, and there must be a lot of people, I go upstairs and think, hey, why have I come up here? Where did I put my gaze or whatever? But I think it's really important to get that point across that there are normal things, but there are also other signs that we need to look out for.
Yeah, so that particular leaflet that you're talking about is actually produced by the Alzheimer's Association here in the U.S., and I think it's fantastic. I share that at all my talks, and people really appreciate that because as exactly as you said, you're like, I lost my keys once. Do I have Alzheimer's disease? Right? There's that immediate worry that this is the sign that I'm finally, and to have that that list is really, really helpful. And usually what I tell people here, again, this is the U.S., I live in California, is I say, if you're worried about yourself or a loved one, look at that list. And after looking at that list, if you're still concerned about yourself or a loved one, go and make an appointment at a place where they will do a comprehensive memory evaluation. So for me in California, I recommend the Stanford VA Alzheimer's Center because they do free memory evaluations. And so you go to somebody, a group that does this, that they've got expertise in this area, kind of versus your regular neurologist. And then based off of that, you can make decisions about your life going forward, right? So hopefully they tell you, you're totally fine. This is typical. No worries here. If things change, come back in 5 years. But if it does come back that your concerns are justified, now you're in a position to really impact the progression of the disease most effectively, right? It's at that early stages that where you have the kind of the most control to set the path of how fast your decline is going to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've always said, and people have said to me, you know, I've lost my gaze, I can't find my gaze. And I say, well, I do that all the time. The time I would worry was when I bring my gaze up and looked at them and said, what do I do with these? Just as an example. But yeah, picking up the point you just made, actually, here in the UK, I've always wondered how much training our doctors actually get in subjects like dementia. And I was told by a general practitioner in the UK, it was one afternoon in a 7-year course, which kind of scared me a bit. I mean, and you were saying there about go to the center, don't go to a normal neurologist. I guess it's the same with you there in the States.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is, you know, that dementia in general is underdiagnosed here. And part of that is, the Alzheimer's Association did a big report on this, is that the general physicians don't screen for it, right? And part of that is because they don't want to give people a diagnosis that doesn't have a cure, right? They don't feel comfortable doing this screening. There's a number of reasons. The patient doesn't bring up the fact that they're concerned about their memory. And so at the general physician level, there's a lot of undiagnosis because of those reasons I just gave. So, you know, I would just say, if, I don't know how it works in the UK, but if there's a, here in the US, it's these centers are usually associated with a research university or a medical school. And that's where I would suggest people go.
Wake up again in an old motel. Is it somewhere different? I can't tell. Every set of curtains opens to the open road. And I'm missing you like hell. This fan is like a prison cell. When I know you have gone with her and I can't go back home. I've been American dreaming. Oh, whoa, I'm American dreaming. Oh, whoa, I'm American dreaming. Oh, whoa, but I never seen. No rest. I should get some rest today, then pack my bags, be on my way. But my mind's always working on the way it could have been. Trying to tow a tightrope line, find a way to feel how fine, without drowning in this wine, calling you again. I've been American dreaming. Oh, 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 I'm American dreaming. Oh, 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 I'm American dreaming. Oh, oh, but I never see no. Want to remind me who I am. If I could just get back home to pick up where we left off, I'd take better care of myself. I'd stop drinking from the bottom shelf. But my old wheels keep spinning and I cannot make them stop. I've been American dreaming. Oh, oh, oh. So I'll get back home and try to be someone that's something like me. But I've forgotten all my angels out here in the wind. Sitting idle with my mind, I meditate to pass the time. But there's something inside sitting sail all over again.
new from Sierra Ferrell from the album Trail of Flowers and American Dreaming, that a new Alzheimer's Society advertising campaign has caused controversy, which has spread around the world, and everyone has a viewpoint. Having tried to get Kate Lee, the Society Chief Executive, on the show, I'm happy to report we've succeeded, and we'll be talking about the advert and reaction to it with the Alzheimer's Society later in the month. This week, we're talking cognitive aging with Quinn Kennedy. And, I read some really interesting stuff that you wrote about visual impairment and, that whole thing, the effects of visual impairment, also looking at certain things that, an expert can spot with just a routine eye examination.
Yeah, and vision and hearing are, low-hanging fruit that you can do to improve your cognitive aging, right? And so they've shown that visual impairment and hearing impairments do increase your risk for dementia, but that can be, ameliorated just by getting a pair of glasses or getting hearing aids, right? And so it's a, pretty straightforward fix to reduce your dementia risk.
And, a lot of these things are fairly simple, aren't they? Which I suppose is a bit frustrating why people don't do them. Another thing that I saw was, I have people living with dementia on the show. I have friends living with dementia. The show was initially called the D word because dementia was a subject that people don't want to mention. But a friend of mine who is living with dementia came on the show a few weeks ago and he said, well, the D word actually stands for don't. Because as soon as I got my diagnosis, I was told, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other, because you won't be able to do that anymore. And one of the things I saw was the ability to help someone to make decisions, so support someone living with dementia to make decisions. And again, it's another myth that just because you got a diagnosis, it doesn't mean you can't make those decisions anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. And, my dad had Alzheimer's and his mother had it. And I certainly remember people did not want to mention the D word, as you put it back then. And now people are more willing to share that information, I think. But where was I going with this? Oh my goodness, I just had my own.
That's all right. You just had your, it's all right. Hands to all of us, Quinn. I was just saying that the D can also stand for don't. And you get a diagnosis, instead of saying concentrating on the things you can do, there's a massive concentration on things that you can't no longer do or people don't want you to do.
Yes. So the point I forgot was this ties into my interest with the financial aspect. And Dr. Peter Littenberg here in the United States has done some really wonderful work in terms of once somebody has a diagnosis of dementia, he does these assessments to determine what aspects of their financial behaviors and financial decision-making are they still able to do and should be doing, and which of those behaviors and decisions should they get some support. And I think it's exactly that balance of what you're talking about is what are they still able to do and you want them to do that? And in which areas do they need that support? I think that's a really, really important point that you made.
Yeah, and that sounds like a really important piece of work as well, because, we've had horror stories here of people being phoned by charities and setting up direct debits and, paying for all sorts of things. Whereas if they had a little bit of help at the beginning, those kind of things kind of wouldn't happen. Another one that really interested me, explained to me a little bit about this one I read. It said strategies to improve memory, such as external aids, habits and routines, may instead impede the ability to remember. I thought that was really interesting. That was one that, that I saw on your website.
Yeah, that was an article I wrote after interviewing Dr. Chris Herzog. About some research that he had done. And yeah, that was some fascinating it's kind of a fascinating perspective that he has. And he and his colleagues had conducted this really extensive intervention in terms of how to help people in terms of the practicalities, everyday memory things, like the things that are important, right? It's not about going into a lab and just repeating back words from a list that they give you, right? Like, honestly, who cares? But what are about the things that you really want to remember in your everyday life? And so they came up with a pretty intensive intervention where they would call their participants every day, see how they did. And they went through this whole process in terms of giving them strategies to help them remember. So that's the article you're referring to. So that was Dr. Christopher Herzog's work.
Yeah, it sounded very interesting. And also, you know, some of the initial tests here in terms of general practitioners or whatever are very much what you've just alluded to, which is some of the things of, you know, you use the who cares, and I think you're absolutely right. Because I'm not going to trade secrets away, but they use a certain address, and I've heard so many people in the UK, it's John Smith, 42, they use the same address. And I'm thinking, this can't be the right way of going about it. Surely we need to be a little more in depth.
Yeah, I mean, I used to not chuckle, but you know, so my dad, as I mentioned, had Alzheimer's disease, and you know, the tests that they would do for him, the MMSC, you know, it's the same questions every single time. And I just remember he would kind of practice answers. Like at one point you had to count backwards by 7. So I would hear him mumbling to himself, you know, 93 and so on and so on. And so I think part of it, there's what I like about what I'm doing with this startup is, you know, these traditional cognitive tests, there's a lot of what we call practice effects. You do it once and you're like, okay, next time I do this, I'm going to remember the basic story. I'm going to remember what they're going to ask me, and I can kind of prepare, you know, I won't say cheat, but, and it's pretty basic information. You know, there's been some jokes here in the U.S. about, you know, you're supposed to get 100 on the MMSC, right? Like it's not a demanding task if you're cognitively healthy. And so what I like about what we're developing at NeuroFit is that it's what we call not gameable. It's simply an eye tracking task. So there's no thought. There's no, you know, you can't cheat at it. It's not gameable. You can do it many, many times and you won't have what we call practice effects. And so I think there's a real need for the clinicals, the clinicians to kind of maybe step away a little bit from these traditional neuropsychological tests to something that encompasses a greater sensitivity of neurological function.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You're here, you're gone, I'm still hanging on. This game ain't nothing new. You've changed your mind so many times. I'm still in love with you. I think love when you walk out the door. Why'd you go leave me safe? you knew what I go through. You'd think you love me well too. Someday I'll find a way. I'll walk right out on you. Till that day comes, I'm still the one. If you should make a fool, I think of love when you're walking out the door. Why'd you go leave me sad and blue? And if you knew what I go through, you'd think it over, you'd think it over, you'd think it over too.
Steve Earle and Think It Over here on The D Word. Well, my guest this week is Quinn Kennedy. One of the other things I read, want to talk to you about, women may have worse outcomes from brain injury and may also have a greater risk of developing dementia. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was from work from a dear friend and colleague, Dr. Maheen Adamson, who works with female veterans here in the United States. And so what her group has found is that female military soldiers, if they experience a traumatic brain injury, they tend to experience worse symptoms than their male counterparts. And then, as you know, traumatic brain injury is in itself a risk for dementia. And so if you've already got these women who have these worse cognitive symptoms from the traumatic brain injury, then they're going to be at an even greater risk for dementia down the line. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's one certainly I hadn't realised. I mean, you know, with everything you do when you start up and getting involved in tech, etc., we've got the NHS here. I know it's a, you know, different situation for you there in the US. But, you know, how do you open the door to the health professionals to, you know, everything you've said in the last 20 minutes makes absolute perfect sense to me. So how do you open the door to get all this into the, you know, the health professionals who are there at the coalface, as it are, with patients coming towards them every day?
That's another great question, Pete. I mean, I feel like, you know, educating the physicians is, you know, obviously always the first start. Providing information to them, such as leaflets that make it easier for them to provide that information to their patients, would also be helpful if that's not already being done. You know, having better, more sensitive screening tools so that they feel more comfortable using them would be helpful. And I think, you know, again, getting back to this, you know, the D word, right? I think having people be more comfortable sharing their concerns about some of their memory issues that they're experiencing with their doctors is also a really important step in that process. Because if you don't tell your physician that you're worried, why would they screen you, right, for cognitive impairment, unless they notice something that's really obvious? And at that point, it's probably, you know, you're probably fairly progressed in the disease.
Now, I think there's a number of parallels. I mean, a lot of people have said to me dementia is now where cancer was 30 years ago. something like that. I had a cancer diagnosis 2 years ago, so to speak from kind of experience of that side of things. And it still seems to be treated, dementia, completely differently in terms of, you know, what you were saying. 30 years ago, I can remember, you know, my grandmother and people were, oh, someone's got it was the C word. And, you know, you were preparing the suit for the funeral as soon as the C word came out. And it just seems to be that dementia, unfortunately, is still kind of, you know, treated in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating. I mean, there's obviously this new genre of treatments that aren't cures, right? They don't cure Alzheimer's disease. They hopefully slow it down a little bit, but that's about it. And, you know, my mom, my dad used to save all these articles about the latest, you know, treatments for Alzheimer's disease. He had a big file of them in his office, and my mom was clearing out his things. He died several years ago. And she's looking at these articles, and she says to me, nothing's changed in 20 years, right? There's still not a cure. They're still using these, you know, these drugs that don't do anything except possibly slow down the cognitive decline a little bit. So I agree that we are similar to cancer and that there's a lot more work that needs to be done before I think scientists will come up with an actual cure.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, we've been talking about the importance of early diagnosis, isn't it? Getting in there first, so you can actually, forge a path forward. I mean, with everything you're doing, you know, with cognitive aging, I guess you know, it's that whole subject is not a parochial one. It's not for the US. It's not for the UK. It's around the world. And I guess you've got contact with people all around the world all looking at the same kind of thing, have you?
Yeah, there's scientists from all over looking at dementia and, of course, cognitive aging. Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of the cognitive aging field, you know, it's great to get you on because I've not talked to anybody that's really looked at that cognitive aging field. As you're saying, that is fairly recent in terms of development. Am I right in saying that?
Well, I would say that it was the late 1960s where the term cognitive aging from a scientist came out. And so when I was in graduate school in the late 90s, it was still a pretty recent field, cognitive aging, I would say. So we're still learning so much. And again, I would argue that we still don't really know. There's so much individuality with aging that I would argue that there's not a typical age-related cognitive progression, right? I mean, some people stay up here forever until they die. Some people, you know, have a really sharp, some people have a more gentle decline. It's kind of all over the place. And so it'd be great to be able to take advantage of some of that huge variability from person to person to say, okay, you're 45, these are the things that you should be doing now to try to keep your cognitive aging trajectory as flat as possible, right? To avoid that cognitive decline and the dementia.
Yeah, and I guess kind of almost coming full circle where we started, in order to do that, you need the people coming forward and recognizing that, hey, oh, maybe I need to go and see someone about that and take the fear factor out of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of it, is just getting over the fear. And I do talk quite a bit about that with people. Usually after the talk, people come up to me and I just really encourage them to go make that appointment as sooner rather than later, and just, you know, take that control while you still can.
Yeah, I think that's, well, time is bringing us to a close, sadly, Quinn, but I think that is a really good point to end it in terms of taking control, because there are modifiable risk factors. And you say that kind of time period, your 40s, 50s, is really essential. And, you know, it's not 100% bleak picture. There are things we can do. And, you know, you're on the forefront, thankfully, of, you know, persuading people of that fact.
Trying. I'm certainly trying.
Well, thank you so much for being my guest. And hopefully we can, you know, touch base in 6 months' time or so, and you can tell me about how things are developing.
I'd love to do that, Pete. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks to Gwen, and hopefully we can catch up with her later in the year. Do take a look at her website at qkconsulting.info. That's all for this week. Thanks to Angela, my production assistant. Next week, it's a welcome back to the D Word for dementia campaigner Derek Brown. So until then, thanks for listening and take care now.